Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And we're very pleased to welcome Harut and Andrew from PinPlanet. Welcome, both of you.
Hello.
Hey, guys. It's nice to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. So I'm excited to talk about your app, PinPlanet, because it's a chance to talk about something from prototype to production since you've been working on it for several years, but hopefully you still remember those early days. So maybe we could start with what is PinPlanet, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, so PinPlanet is an app that lets you pin where you've been. It's a way to keep track of all your travel memories in one place. So like, let's say, for example, that you visit Portugal and somebody asks you about it later. They want to know your travel recs. PinPlanet helps you essentially keep track of all of that. You'll be able to go back and tell them all the spots you visited, like the restaurants, the hotels, museums, etc. You can keep track of your photos. You have your travel buddies. So it also functions as like a trip planner. And then you get to visualize all of your pins on a 3D globe as well as a 2D map.
That was one of the things that's most striking when I first signed up for it, is that 3D globe. Can I ask, what are you using to generate that? I know that's not Django, but what are you using to generate the globe?
So I have to ask, which globe are you talking about? The one in the getting started or the one on the profile now?
Oh.
Because they're two different globes.
Yeah. That's true. Either. tell me how they're different.
I can answer both.
Yeah. So,
The one that's in the getting started prompts is our older globe. It was a web globe that I built in JavaScript using D3. And then the newer globe takes advantage of Apple's MapKit. So they have a way to render 3D globe. It's a little bit more performant.
Okay.
So we started using that one on the profiles instead of the web one.
Okay, very cool.
Okay, and the back end is, are you using GeoDjango? Is this?
Yeah,
is this
we are.
Yeah, all right, good. You, we're on a Django show. go on, tell us about that. What's the down and dirty though? Like, how do you build such an app? Because it's quite cool to play with, and you know.
Okay, so the front end is completely native. We did start as a web app, and we're definitely happy to talk about the PWA aspects as well. But so the front end is iOS for right now. We are in the midst of building an Android app, and we're actually getting pretty close to releasing it. The back end is Django. And obviously a little bit of GeoDjango. And then our database is Postgres. We have Redis server running for cache. Everything runs on EC2 instances. So that's like the quick and dirty.
Right. So brilliant. But so it's literally just the two of you.
Yes, we are. We're the engineering team.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's what I want to know. How's it going building a Django backend? Okay. And just, you know, a few EC2 instances scaling. Okay. Fine. No problem. A PWA to begin with. Okay. You know, get that. Then an iOS app. Oh, hang on. And then an Android. How do two pairs of hands get quite so much done? It must be a challenge.
I don't even know how to answer that. I'll answer it a little bit. I think that we're like a pretty efficient engineering team. Andrew and I's skills, we complement each other really well. That's my answer, but I want to hear what Andrew thinks.
It's about as hectic as you kind of made it seem and sound.
Perfect.
Yeah, especially with adding iOS in. We're supporting so many different versions of the app, and with a PWA, it was just one thing, and it's been a bit, but yeah, like Harut said, every time I have an issue, I go to him, and he tells me, "Oh, you missed this very obvious thing," or vice versa, and so it works out very well.
And let me just say on the air that Andrew is my Python guy. So I know Python pretty well, but if I really like want to get into Python details, then I go to Andrew. So I think this synergy works really well between
us. So now who's iOS, are you both writing Swift or are you dividing that and versus, you know, Java for Android? How is that division of labor happening?
So I do iOS fully. Andrew has been taking over the Android app. I help a little bit over there. It's more like maybe like an 80-20 split. And then both of us also do backend, handle database stuff, handle server stuff. But that's more, I would say, Andrew's specialty is backend. But I'm, you know, I'm comfortable getting in there as well.
Okay. And since we're in that, like, Andrew, have you been digging into the whole Kotlin thing in Android? Or
yeah.
Is it still Java-based?
We're 100%. Kotlin and Jetpack Compose.
Right, brilliant. And so for the listeners, like Jetpack Compose is a bit like Swift UI. It's one of these declarative UI frameworks that you can just sort of spell it out and then the runtime works out how to render it. And so you're not, it's simpler and quicker, I guess.
Yes, simpler in syntax. The titular composition aspect of Jetpack Compose is sometimes it feels inconsistent and like a bear to wrestle with, but I'm sure that's personal failing.
It's an understatement from the little right, bits that so I've had to help out.
So the essential complexity of UI design didn't just disappear somewhere?
It didn't.
Right, okay. So here's my burning question about Kotlin, since you've been doing it. You go on the Kotlin website, sort of like, you know, a cross-platform, multi-this, multi-that, and then they got this thing down the bottom where it says iOS, and I'm thinking, oh, so is it yet at the case that you're building chunks of your app in it for both iOS and Android in Kotlin?
We're not doing that, and we're not going to go in that direction. We're sticking with native for both, which is, yes, a lot of work.
So can I ask why? Because and this comes back to the idea of, well, you know, PWAs, or why don't just ship a PWA and ship it to every platform? Why go native in the first place? You know, why not try and use the cross-platform Kotlin? Like, what does native only give you?
Well, it depends what exactly you're asking for. So is it the difference between PWA versus native iOS, or is it something like Kotlin multi-platform, which is saying, all right, you're going to use one code base to also build iOS and Android? Because the answers are different.
Right, no, but it kind of is both, right? Because I'm still basically fascinated by the fact that the two of you are building a backend plus multiple front ends, like with just one pair of hands. And that's kind of incredible in a way. It's kind of really hard to do. And to do it at high quality, you know, that's a lot of effort. So I'm kind of trying to tease from you the decisions that lead you to go that hardest of routes.
Okay. All right. So the easier way to answer this is why we didn't go Kotlin multi-platform. I think it's mostly me. I just don't believe in these cross-platform solutions. They always sell it a lot better than it actually is. Like, you get the first 50% done really well and really fast, but then the second 50%, you're pulling your hair out and you go gray by the end of it. So that's the reason for that. The reason we went from PWA to native is because that's more complicated. We've trained users for 10 plus years, you know, over a decade, to look for apps in the App Store. So when you tell them, oh, I built this app, and they're like, oh, okay, what is it called? Let me look for it in the App Store. And we're like, oh, it's actually not in the App Store. And trying to get over that hurdle is very, very difficult.
That and notifications.
That and push notifications. So.
Yeah, that was gigantic.
There's a lot of people in the world who are kind of cross with the way that PWAs just aren't as capable as native apps.
It's really unfortunate, because like 2 years ago, I was such a huge advocate of the web, and I still love the web. I think the web is the best cross-platform solution. There's nothing that comes close to like the cross-platform capabilities of the web, because every platform essentially has some version of a browser, and that's awesome. But yeah, Apple in particular does their absolute best to just make that experience not so great.
I mean, I think the Basecamp app is like that, right? It's essentially web views with a very small native wrapper around it to integrate with the iOS. But essentially all of the views are exactly the same you get on the Basecamp website.
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. Right, so one more question here, and then I'm going to let Will have a go, because I've got you both on the hook. So the big impedance match for me is the serialization between. So you've got your Python backend, and you serialize to, I don't know, your JSON objects, and then you deserialize into your Swift objects, and or you know, your Kotlin objects or whatever. So can you describe how you've dealt with that, and what your pain points have been, and you know what you've enjoyed and what you haven't, and you know, we'll, I think, follow up there. But also, there's another little switch back to that Kotlin bit. Would you reuse the Kotlin bit just for that kind of networking layer? Or, you know, is that just, it just doesn't bring enough to the table?
Yeah, I can speak to the Kotlin aspect of that. I've only been using Kotlin for, I guess, 3 or 4 months, 3 months
yeah.
or so.
Well, it's remarkable that you've been able to build the app in 3 months, so.
Been a lot of work, but I've really, really enjoyed Kotlin and have been very impressed by how intuitive the syntax can be. The library we're using for the client-side HTTP is KTOR, and that's also a server-side. So I think one of my next projects will be a Kotlin server-side application just to mess around with that. But for now, I think we're, just because of the complexity of a two-man team managing four machines, two platforms, we'll stick with just one for now. But
and let me answer.
Yeah, I'll just chase.
I'll answer the serialization piece, which I think is interesting. It's basically double the amount of work, and there's no way around that. Like, we have our DRF serializers, which, you know, will serialize and deserialize the data, and we've slipped that into input and output serializers nowadays. And then in Swift or Kotlin, you know, we have essentially very similar ways to, you know, quote unquote, serialize the data into Swift and Kotlin objects.
Right, but you end up writing a set of kind of almost boilerplatey classes in Python. And it doesn't matter if you're using DRF serializers or, you know, Pydantic or Atters and Catters, like it's still boilerplate. It's still rubbish to write. And then you've got the same in Swift with the coding, you know, the coding protocol or whatever it's called. But it's again, and they've got lots of utilities, like they know how to map from Python names to Swift names. And okay, great. But it's still rubbish to write those. And you spend a lot of time doing that, right?
Yeah. There's no way around it. I feel like we bit the bullet a while ago. And we're like, that's okay.
It's cost.
Okay, so that's good. I'm glad nothing changed. But what about LLMs and Copilot and these things? Have they anything there to speed up all of your work?
I think we used ChatGPT one time a while ago, probably 6 or 7 months ago, and it helped.
Yeah, there was some weird web view layer we were doing. So we're trying to send some data to the web view for the old globe. And then there was like one line that we got from ChatGPT. But for the most part, I don't actually ever use ChatGPT. But I do the support in PyCharm, I think, if that counts, is pretty good.
Actually, I can say that I've used ChatGPT a few more times. It's never given me any code that was... something. It's never given me any changes, any code I could include, mostly because I've been troubleshooting very complicated problems, and the difficulties almost always at this point with something so mature and like as many files as we have, explaining what the problem is. And if you can do that, you have a pretty good shot of fixing it yourself.
So you're still essentially, the bottom line is you're still, when it comes to the serialization, deserialization, you're still sort of having to maintain that mapping layer. You know, by hand. Yeah.
Okay. Have either of you, we recently had Simon Willison on, who's obviously a big advocate of LLMs. But I mean, have you tried, was it Pi Assistant, right? That's the new PyCharm one that they just launched. I haven't had a chance to play with it myself, but it's sort of like their co-pilot that they just, the new update to PyCharm.
I did recently try it. I didn't like it, actually. I thought it was kind of, it was like a little annoying because some of the suggestions were just not right. And it kept doing weird casing. Like it would give me camel case in Python.
Ooh.
Is that the right one? Yeah, not the underscore, not the snake case. Right. It gave me camel case names. And I was like, why are you doing that? Yeah. Like, you know, this is Python. So,
well, Carlton, you like Copilot though, right? You?
Yeah, no, but I like it for these kind of boilerplatey things. I like it, you know, I'm like, I had a, okay, so today I was writing a property that maps from choice fields and make sure it's displayed in the right way. And it's like, okay, I need some tests for it. So I select it, Copilot, I need some tests for this. And it gives me the half a dozen cases. And I don't have to type them out by hand. I'm like, okay, that's fine. And the rest of it's, you know, not useful. But that little bit saves me a few minutes. And I used to write APIs for a living. So back in the day, I used to write iOS apps with a DRF backend. And the bane of my life was this mapping from serialization to deserialization. And every time it updates and every change, it's like, okay, I've got to make a change in the app to the serializer, change in the DRF backend to the serializer, make sure that that's backwards compatible or introduce a versioned endpoint. It was kind of like the legwork of the, you know, it's not difficult. It's not challenging. It's not it, but it's the stuff that needs to be done, the grind work. And my hope with these toolings is that they can automate that in some way, that they can take away a little bit of the mundanity of that particular mapping task, which it, you know, it's not difficult, but it's time consuming.
I think the direct integration into IDEs is going to be the biggest value add for, I mean, this is a very obvious thing to say, but for developers, just because swapping back and forth between Windows, copying and pasting, waiting for the output there, and just the amount of task switching, it is a higher cost to your productivity than I think either of us were willing to take to fit that into our workflow.
The other kind of issue is that we're both of us are jumping between two IDEs. We both use PyCharm, and then I also use Xcode, and Andrew uses Android Studio. So it's like kind of, it's a little tricky, you know, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I guess part of me is, I'm sorry, I'm going to keep banging the same drum all episode, I realize. But so this part, the promise of the Kotlin layer is that if you could incorporate that as a library into your iOS app, that mapping could be done like once in the one layer. But whether or not I can, I don't, you know, I'm not going to ask the same question again. You haven't got there yet.
All right. Well, we dove right into it, but I'm actually curious if we could back up to how you two met. How like your backgrounds in programming and how it led you to Django, because that's always interesting to hear. I know you both, I believe, studied at George Mason University. Is that right? And maybe that's how
yes.
you met.
Yeah.
Is that how you met as well?
We met through a friend that I guess also went to Mason, and then we've been working together ever since. I can tackle the question first if you want, just quickly go through my background. So I studied math, like applied math and computational mathematics at Mason. I did a lot of programming. I actually, surprisingly, I'll say this on the air, I took AP Computer Science in high school and I just did horribly. It was in Java. It was just like the worst experience. And then I retook the class a couple months later after the AP exam in college, and it was in Python, and I did much, much better and everything just clicked. I don't know if it was because I didn't like Java or just because Python's a great language, but that was kind of where it started. And then, you know, as every math major unfortunately goes through, you do a lot of MATLAB when you're doing kind of computational programming. This was, you know, just a life that I lived for a couple of years. Then I went back to Python. I did some data science, was a data analyst for a little bit. And then at some point after that, like, you know, while doing data science, I started building tools for people. And this for me was just like the big switch. When I started building like tools for data scientists, for business analysts, for project managers, I realized, okay, like software engineering is a thing that I really love. And then, and Python has always been my go-to choice for building backends. I jumped around, I did Flask, I did FastAPI, I did Django, and then kind of did the entire rotation again. I guess FastAPI wasn't as big at the time when I first started. And then, I don't know, something about Django just, I mean, this is so cliche to say, but like the batteries included aspect, the stability, the maturity of the framework, I was just like, yeah, this is awesome. I'm just going to use this.
That response, like it was the look on your face as you said it. It's like somehow it's like when you're building an application, it just sort of gets out of your way. And you know, there might be different frameworks, different options, but Django's quite sweet in its way. It's quite, you know, it's had all the edges knocked off it over the years, so it fits the whole very well.
Yeah. All right, Andrew, you wanna?
Sure. And so also went to Mason. I studied math and physics and didn't do hardly any programming for a very long time. I took one computational data science class, CDS 130, did a little bit of MATLAB, did not enjoy it at all. And then said, I think I'll be able to have a career as a physicist with no programming, very naively. And both of those things were wrong. So I didn't end up going and doing grad school. And later on at Mason, I decided, you know what, I really should learn how to program, and started with Python again and read through Jake Vanderplas's amazing whirlwind tour of Python and Python Data Science Handbook. And those are some of my favorite books that I've read on learning Python. Love those. So I read through those, did some automate the boring stuff, and then found my way at a bank as an analyst doing work with pandas for about a year, moved on to being an analyst, just doing SQL for 8 hours a day for 2 years, found my way back to working on huge models with terabytes of data in PySpark. And then eventually Harut and I started working together right after that in a startup doing Django. I was doing Django. When he told me he wanted to do Django for the back end, I had a trip to Chicago planned. So I got all my stuff together, got on a train, and the train was like 18, 20 hours. I just did the Django tutorial on the train. I did the DRF tutorial on the train. And I think to this day I do about 30% of my code is written on an Amtrak.
Super. So do you commute regularly, or do you just have to go on special trips to get anything done?
Oh man, it's got to be both. It has to be it. I go down to, I'm in Arlington now, and I head down to Richmond to see family and friends pretty regularly. Train's just the perfect place to work. Cheaper than an office, probably.
Cheaper than a co-working, yeah.
Back when I was in college, I went to William & Mary for undergrad, and I would go up to Boston, which is almost as long as it can go. It's about 15 hours, but this is 20 plus years ago. So I would just read 2-3 books. And but there is something, you know, as an adult or as a parent, you know, to Carlton's point, to like not be interrupted, you know, train is sort of like daytime, you know, middle of the night, no one's going to bother you vibes, which is, hard to come by.
It's great. And you cannot leave. You can't distract yourself with something else. Wi-Fi is too slow to stream. Right. You've got no excuses.
Yeah. So just don't download the series before you leave. So you've got nothing. So Pinplanet, Geodata. So come on, we don't talk enough about GeoDango, I think, on the show. It's like probably the best geo platform, you know, for the web out there, and yet we hardly ever mention it. So give us your experience with GeoDango, and you know,
Andrew, do you want to talk about this?
Sure. GeoDango on macOS is our current setup for local dev, and we don't have it in Docker, which has led to some frustrations. It by far the most difficult part was getting it installed. Getting everything working, all the correct versions of everything, making sure it's detected, pointing Django at the right in the settings at the right GDAL files and all that stuff. It's utilities.
It's fair to say that we still have nightmares about GDAL and proj installation.
Yeah. And absolutely.
Brew.
Yeah, and brew doesn't help in this case. It just, things become a gigantic mess.
If there was a Docker image to end all images, would that help or no? Because
we used to work in Docker, but honestly, at some point, I just got annoyed with like having to remount, and then the container cache is maybe sometimes a little too strong, so you have to rebuild the entire container setup, and then it just ruins your flow. So at some point, I remember talking to Andrew. I was like, let's just run GUnicorn directly on our dev machines, and it's just so much faster.
If you can't tell, we're really into doing things that do not scale.
Yeah,
so that's just
They scale eventually.
Yeah,
and it's just the two of you, so you can get away with both figuring out your local dev setup, right? If it was 20 of you, then I think that's where the Docker pain is kind of worth it.
Maybe these are the perks of a 2-person team currently.
I think so.
Yes. Yeah.
But anyways, so once it's installed, though, there's obviously Django project docs, but like, how do you learn that? How did you baby step your way to, building Pinplanet with it?
So the...
Well, let's talk about our use case first. Yeah. So the reason why we wanted to use GeoDango and really PostGIS is because we wanted to be able to automatically capture, like, if you pin somewhere from the lat long, we want to know what continent that's in, and then that also extended to what country that's in, so we can run some continent and country stats, like, that are on the profile. So we took a bunch of JS data, we put it in. It's about like 100 megabytes. I think it's like, you could even look it up. It's the coastlines 1 meter resolution thing.
OSM data.
Yeah. We put that in PostGIS, and then every time you pin a place, we run an ST, I think it's ST contains, an ST contains right. query to basically say, take this point, this lat long point, and then tell us like which of these countries it's in, and then which continent it's in. So that's like the extent of our current PostGIS use, but we want to extend that to cities as well, so we can also start capturing some city data.
Yeah, the extent to what we use GeoDjango for is that ST contains. That's very nice to not have to write some raw queries and be able to do that. It's really convenient to be able to just slightly extend the ORM with the GeoDjango extension. It gives me a lot more confidence about having that work in the future.
You're not going to write it yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess the biggest issue we've run into has been when we tried to parallelize testing outside of installation, when we tried to parallelize testing because we, recreating that database with all the geodata in it was a bit of a pain.
Because this is one of the cases where you need the 100 megabytes of your GIS data in the database, even if you recreate it. So we have to re-import it every time you recreate the database. It's a little bit of a testing, like there's some hassle there.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's some clever DB snapshotting technique you could use where you just sort of swap in a snapshot and go bam, and then speed that up. But I, you know, haven't got one to hand. Listeners,
if you find one, send it our way, because that would make our testing much faster and easier.
That does give me an idea, though. Thank you for saying that.
I'm sure there's some Postgres thing that does that. I'll look it up when we're offline, and I'll see if I can find.
Search. So I had fun playing around with your search. Can I ask what are you using to power that? How is it building out search? Because that's a non-trivial thing too.
What search?
I typed in just zip code for a place. For example, I guess once I was all logged in, there was a place for a place that where you've been. I typed in zip code, or I typed in the name.
For our search, we use Apple Maps, and thankfully in Swift they actually have a way to you could just start typing stuff in and they send the request for you. So this is really useful. And then we're actually also using Apple Maps, but their server APIs for Android to have a consistent search experience.
I've been for a while, excuse me. I've been for a little while trying to convince Harut to make our worst decision yet, which is to take the terabyte of OSM data out there, loaded into a PostGIS instance, and host our own search functionality with that. Awful idea. Use something that's already out there. But
the worst part is that when you're two engineers and both of you guys know like how to do stuff like this and you're excited by big tasks, like I'm sometimes like, well, maybe we should do that. And then I think you got a terabyte of data to host. You're going to have to do caching and all this stuff. So we
look at our issues list and decide.
Yeah, that's a good procrastination thing. It's like, ooh, like this big, I think that's a universal feeling.
This is every engineering decision ever, ever writ large. No, it's like, we want to do this ourselves because clearly we'll do better than what's available, but can we?
Yeah, it's all about the journey anyways.
So for the place search, so like if you go back to the explore page and you start typing stuff in, that one actually is, I think it's just an iContains right now. We had considered setting up Elasticsearch, but there, I guess it's the prioritization is the real answer for why we haven't done that. We want to improve search.
And then you'd explore Postgres search before going all the way to Elastic, right? To a separate thing.
I'd set up a full text search, set up for that functionality and tweaking it. It wasn't great. I'd set up trigram search as well, and we just couldn't get the results to feel good when you're like actually searching it. So we'd always type in some really people are going to look for London, right? Or New York. And you could get one to work well and one to just not work well at all. And yeah, we gave up, and iContains just, it works really well. It gives you what you expect.
See, that's my favorite story.
Yeah, it wasn't an issue. I mean, I think there was something like I added in like DjangoCon US and I typed in Durham and, you know, just Durham, and the default was in the UK, which makes sense. But then I just added, you know, NC. I mean, it was, you know, it was more than sufficient, and searches, you know, everyone compares you to Google. So it is sort of like it asymptotes pretty quickly on the results unless you're building a search engine yourself. Anyways, okay, that was one thing I wanted to ask about. Can we talk about the PWA? How did you, so what actually was the PWA? What was that set up?
Okay, yeah. So the way that this initially happened and was my girlfriend, who maybe the one beginning portion of the story that we didn't talk about. So this idea came from my girlfriend wanting to pin all the places she had been to. And this started in November 2021. So at the time, because I had done so much web development and I was working at a company where it almost felt like I was at an agency, I was just constantly building new projects. I said, all right, let me see if I can take what you want, which is an app, and build it on the web. And that's where the kind of the PWA came up. I realized like, oh, okay, you can actually add stuff. You can save it directly to your home screen. It'll function like an app. So I ended up writing tons and tons of JavaScript, which I'll say this on the air. I like JavaScript. I don't have an issue with it. I don't think it's a better language than Python. So, but in any case, I built the initial versions of it as a web app. And we even promoted it pretty heavily as a web app. I, you know, got a bunch of people to install it. And then about 3 months into it, Andrew and I started working together on it as well, because a one-person engineering team for such a big project just doesn't work. And now I can't imagine, I can't even remember what it was like to work on this without Andrew also being here. But we had a web app. Obviously, the constraints that I talked about at the beginning of the episode, which is like finding web apps in the app store, that functionality doesn't exist, push notifications don't exist, Apple makes the experience not so great. We bit the bullet and said, all right, we should probably just go native.
Hard to convince the users to come to you, especially when you have so little visibility. So you gotta go to where they are.
Yes, but like the visibility in the app store is not great unless you're like one of the chosen five apps they put on the, you know, the homepage there. Like you'd never find Pin Planet by browsing, right? You'd never find, you know, some other indie app by browsing. So it's, you've got to do the same amount of marketing.
Well, so the cool thing actually is that similar to SEO, there is ASO, which is App Store Optimization. And if you get the keywords right, you can actually rank for stuff, which is somewhat surprising.
Huge increase in signups from one keyword tweak.
Yeah, we've done small keyword tweaks here and there to see. The trickiest part is actually thinking like, well, you know, this kind of app isn't like the norm. You know, Instagram is the norm nowadays. Like if you think about, all right, I want to upload my photo somewhere or social media stuff, you think of that. But pinning all the places you've been to isn't something that people are always thinking about. So one of the hardest parts of this project is actually thinking like, all right, well, what would a user potentially type in to find the kind of thing that we've created?
Yeah. I mean, one, I don't know if you thought of this angle. One, I'm familiar with families that have like a family, you know, map, right? And then they pin like where the family has gone or like, you know, different colors, like if somebody for big. So I don't know if the family angle plays into it at all. I would think it's more like the 20 something backpacking crowd would be like the default. But there's also, I don't know, a number of families I know have that big thing. And we're always like, oh, we should have that, but we don't have a wall that would work for it. But yeah, it's a tricky thing, I guess. Well, you know, that's why there's business problems separate from tech problems, I guess, right? So
yeah.
Carlton, you have a question?
So in that case, then I guess it's that journey. It's like, how are you finding scaling it? You're obviously coping, but there comes a point in which, you know, you're going to need a third pair of pants and a fourth now to keep growing.
Yeah, I think right now that if we were to bring on another person, we'd probably bring on someone that does more marketing, honestly, because Anna on the other end, who's our third co-founder, she's kind of alone in that regard. Like I try to help out as much as I can with marketing, but that's obviously I'm not amazing at it. Although I have been putting together TikTok videos, which is another story. But yeah, we'd hire a marketing person, and Andrew and I would just continue to work together. It's not fair to her, because like if we got another engineer and she's like still alone doing all the marketing and stuff by herself, you know.
Yeah, no, I get it. But you feel like, in the flip side of that, you must feel like you're not drowning. You're like you're doing fine. You're running the servers, you're running the back end, you're building the front end platform, the front end applications. You seem to be handling that very well.
We've spent a lot of time and put quite a bit of effort into building out that kind of supporting tech infrastructure. We've put a lot of time into our testing. We didn't start out with testing. We added it several months in, and that was a big dedicated effort where we said we want to test. I think we just did all of our views.
Yeah.
And we've just maintained that coverage. We've got like 93% coverage. I think we checked recently, we have almost 500 assert statements.
I mean, yeah. Which gives us a lot of confidence to like continue to, you know, shift stuff around and build new features in the back end. So
it took a lot of time, but it saved many times more.
So that's one half of the story. The other half actually is we spent a considerable amount of time like using Ansible, like writing our own playbook so that we can spin stuff up if we ever need to, which actually has happened multiple times where like, you know, I wish I could remember a good one to say, or like a good reason why we brought down one of our servers and then we brought it back up like within just a couple minutes. I think it was Redis. I think we had done something with our Redis server, and then we decided like, all right, you know what, this is not working. We want to upgrade to a larger server. We just brought that one down and brought the new one up, and like it was so fast. And it gives you so much confidence to know that, okay, even if something happens to the API server, we'll create a new server, a new EC2 server, and then we'll run Ansible and we're good. And that really, really does give you a lot of comfort.
It takes, you know, 5 minutes for us to deploy as many of these servers as we want because of, you know, the time investment into Ansible up front, which was, you know, maybe 2 or 3 days spread out a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Were you always on EC2, or I believe I read somewhere you were Heroku at one point, or did you always go EC2?
No. We've always been EC2.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Right. And I assume that's because you both have prior experience in work settings using EC2. Or you just jumped right to EC2 just because that's what the big kids do?
I think he's looking at me to confirm. Yes, we both have experience with EC2.
Andrew's actually more comfortable with AWS because of his work when he was in banking. I used to work at a company where you could like just go to an internal website and provision a new Linux server. So for me, and that was like the easiest way to basically set stuff up. So both of us have a lot of experience like running stuff directly on Linux, and I don't know, I guess maybe we just find that it's easier.
Yeah, it's very, we get a machine. We don't get someone's platform. We don't get like the specialty hosting. We get a machine. I can SSH into it. I can do what I want. That's, to me, that's simpler. So yeah, that's why we stuck with EC2.
But let me say that, and I think this happens to us from time to time, when newer, younger, junior engineers say like, oh, well, how should we go about deploying this? I never recommend AWS. I never recommend an EC2 instance. I never recommend anything Linux. I'm like, use a PaaS. It's so much easier. You have Heroku, you have Fly. There's a bunch of them. It makes it so, so much easier. Because I think the unfortunate thing is like, it can be really scary. And when you're new to programming and deployment and you see all the work you have to put in, you're like, oh man, this is what I got to go through.
And yeah, it's like a cliff of complexity.
Yes.
It's like, wow, all of that. So I want to dig into your testing. So you're testing the Django, your Django application mainly kind of with the Vue test, the API client or the test client, and testing sort of the Vue interface. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then I imagine you've got, you know, if you've got special model methods or whatever, you might have a particular unit test to cover that, because, you know, helps you write the thing if nothing else. What about testing against the front end application? So how do you test your iOS app or your Android app?
Yeah, how do we test our iOS?
We don't, unfortunately. Yeah. The problem with the front end is it's so dynamic, it's dynamic in terms of how frequently things are changing. And unfortunately, this is probably the point where the two-person team breaks down a little bit. We just don't have the manpower to say, all right, let's go through and do the same amount of testing for our front end.
We spend so much time learning new ways to do things and mistakes that we were making that we would have to rewrite our tests so frequently. More frequently than I think we'd catch anything breaking, because things haven't really been breaking too much.
Well, fingers crossed.
Yeah. Don't nervous say.
But, right. But actually,
wait till you get off the show.
Yeah, exactly. I will say the one thing that's actually useful here is that both Swift and Kotlin are type languages. And both of us have written, obviously use Python and JavaScript, which are super dynamic, but the type languages can actually save you from a lot of these really little mistakes.
I did not
appreciate
what you get from that kind of strict typing and explicit typing with these languages. And man, I really like it.
Yeah.
It's not a necessity for me going forward. I'm still very happy with Python. I still enjoy writing that more, but it has not been an impediment for writing Kotlin. It's forced me to think more about what I'm writing and code reusability. It's been a very nice feature, not in my way at all, surprisingly.
It's like if it runs, there's a reasonable chance it runs right.
Yeah.
Yeah, surprisingly, actually. Yeah.
Who would have thought?
Well, that's one of the open questions, I guess, in the Django community is, you know, whether to mandate or support typing. And so far, they haven't weighed in, because there is obviously the trade-off for beginners if you say, okay, it just raises the bar a bit more. And yet, I would say the majority of projects at scale seem to use some sort of typing with Python because... yeah, it saves you time in the long run.
Can I just say that I'm very pro type hints for Django as well? And I follow the issue and I'm like, God, I really hope they get to this soon, but I don't know. But we actually use type hints for everything that's not Django in Python.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, everything we've written, I think.
Yeah, like all of our utility methods and stuff, we type hint.
And do you using like a type checker with that as well? Like you're doing...
We're just using a built-in PyCharm. The problem is I installed MyPy and then it complained that all of the Django stuff isn't typed. So
Yeah, I know that if you read the MyPy docs in some depth, it talks about how to progressively type your project, but it's really hard to get anything going at all. It's like I'm here for a day and I'm still getting 1,000 errors, and maybe I'm not clever enough to work out all the config options, but... surely there should be a MyPy progressive command that just sort of says, look, we'll start off with this one. Can you fix this one? Okay, you fix that one. Can you fix this one now? But that doesn't exist.
So we've mentioned performance, but I'm curious, as you've gone from prototype to production, have there been some notable big performance issues that cropped up and how did you deal with them? I mean, I'm sure there are, but you know, just like speeding up your tests or... caching, like, are there anything that come to mind? Because I find those are always interesting to hear what pops up as you scale.
One of the testing speedups, we actually, it was an issue that we ran into at first where we had, we were still sending our images, because you can upload images for your places, and we have some sample images, and we mock the upload because we have a lot of custom stuff in that. They were still getting sent to S3 through tests. And I think S3 right now is littered with a bunch of test images.
Yeah. Test underscore one, test underscore two.
Yeah. Yeah.
A million of those. So finding the right testing configurations, overriding your storage's config, which was with the new 4.2 update for a while, it was tough to get the storage pointed towards a local, towards storing locally.
Yeah. We couldn't get file system storage to work in testing after the 4.2 upgrade. And we followed the issue, and some people had very similar issues, but not exactly. And then I don't know what we did. It works now.
4.2.4.
Oh, 4.2.4, I guess, maybe. Yeah. Had a fix for it.
There's a small line in the patch notes about something. I think it's like prioritizing how it gets storage. It gets the proper storage. I don't recall exactly what it was, but it fixed it. It works now. But we talked about earlier for performance for testing. We tried parallelizing it, which worked really well until we needed to load in all that OSM coastline data.
Oh, actually, you know what's a really good performance thing that I'll start it, but Andrew will finish it. For our explore page, when you first click it open and you get all of the people's pins, we have a monster SQL query for that. We don't have any, there's no machine learning just yet. We had considered putting it in, but again, perks of a two-person team, it's a little too much effort. But that was taking multiple seconds. It was taking maybe 1 or 2 seconds in dev. And then I ran it in prod and it was like multiple seconds. And then I told Andrew, I was like, okay, we have an issue. And then.
Yeah, that was. So we have this ranking of all of our places, ranking with noise. And it looked at all 10,000 of our pins. And it did a lot of. It did a lot of operations, a lot of counts, a lot of over windows and partition. This is all ORM, by the way, which has been very nice. And we managed to cut it down to, what, like 150, 200 milliseconds?
So, yeah, roughly, something like that.
Just by excluding ones that we knew we wouldn't use. So the simplest solution cut out a ton of our actual query time where we just went in and we're not going to want to present, you know, in the Explorer things without images, right? It's going to be a boring thing to look at and they're not going to get to it anyway. No one's going to scroll to 4,000.
And this is like a crazy 6-way, 7-way join. Like so much data is coming. We basically aggregate our entire database and we're wondering why, like, oh man, why is this so slow?
Yeah, good.
It's like when you cut stuff out.
I mean, what's nice is that you've got multi-second query, bit of brain work comes down to, you know, quick enough.
It's yeah.
Often the case, like people are like, oh, why is it Django slow? Or no, your query is slow. Let's fix your query and we fix the problem, right?
Carlton, was it Matthias's Django image field that we just highlighted in the newsletter, right? I think you, was that?
Yes. Yeah, last week. I'm using that on a project. It's just a little field that lets you upload an image, and pick a point of interest, a place in the image to sort of be the focal point in case it gets cropped. And I wanted that for avatar images. You know, you upload an image, you want to crop it round, and you want to say, look, that's the bridge of my nose there. So, well, that's the point of my nose. And there are various options, For various reasons, I wanted to use that one because it's less code.
That's cool, actually. I haven't heard of that either. One. Yeah, well, we can look into that.
Well,
You
don't subscribe to the Django News newsletter because it was featured in there.
I read every single one of those. I haven't missed one.
me too. Me too. Sometimes. Yeah.
I don't know what it is. Maybe I prefer the podcast over reading. I don't know what it is. Every time I see a podcast episode, I'm like, oh boy, here we go.
Oh, good.
That's how I stay up to date with all the stuff in Django. For real, though, people are surprised. Like, how do you know all this stuff about Django? And I'm like, there's an amazing podcast. It really does help.
I just spend too much time on Twitter.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I feel a little bit better because sometimes I feel like I'm repeating myself because, you know, if it's like in the newsletter, we mention it on the podcast, maybe I write something about it. But I know that not everyone is following every single thing that I do. So I need to, that's good to hear.
I will say just one comment about the images. Our problems with images actually weren't even in Django. They were client side, because when you are uploading images straight from your phone, we're talking, I mean, nowadays, like 5 to 10 megapixel images are not, it's not out of the norm. Multiply that by potentially 10, 20, 30. Like if you add photo dump images to your place, plus you add images to each of your spots, that's like, I remember the first time I had Anna pin something, it took over a minute and she had like 5 or 6 images. And I thought, that's a problem. So we actually have to handle compression on the front end and resizing before we can even send it.
Brilliant. And so you will actually crop the image on the client before uploading it, or yeah?
Yeah. We don't crop, but we do resize, and we add a very light amount of compression to bring it around 500 KB, and then that makes the request significantly faster.
And we know what dimensions we're going to present to the user. And
yeah, right. So no point having outside of that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's been the nice part about developing for mobile. Yeah, you've got a bunch of different screen sizes, but versus, you know, if you're developing for desktop web, I don't have to support and care about a 34-inch monitor.
Yeah.
and the 21-inch monitor at the same time.
Yeah. And the angry user who uploaded their panoramic picture that
yeah. You know. Why can't this be full quality 100 meg?
Yeah.
Well, we're coming up a little on time. Can you tell us like what's next for Pin Planet, right? Like you have obviously an Android app coming. Are there any new things you're excited about working on related to it?
So I think the Android app is the biggest one. We have tons and tons of people that are asking about it on Android, and I guess now, hopefully, I'm not sure when the podcast will come out, but I imagine the Android app will be out either before then or very close. The other kind of cool thing that we're doing is we're building a version of Pin Planet for the Vision Pro, the Apple Vision Pro.
Ooh.
And hopefully that will be
cool.
Coming out. We put a video out, like a short snippet out on YouTube, and we posted it on our socials and stuff, and there seems to be a little bit of interest there. I can't afford the Vision Pro goggles, but I can build for them.
See, I got 4 kids. I can't afford them.
I've seen that in the simulator. When you show that to me, it looks really cool.
Yeah.
And, oh, we're on iPad too.
Oh yeah, yeah. Pin Planet does actually also work on iPad.
Oh, how is that a recent thing, or is that also supporting
that
iPad?
That was back in October. Most of the work was figuring out how to automatically resize images based on the width. And then once I figured that out, it actually turned out to be not super difficult to do. So,
Well, there's so many different sizes of iPads these days, but I guess on your end, it wasn't like 3 times as much work to support 3 different sizes with like the Mini, the Air, and the Pro.
Surprisingly not. No, no. Once we figured out how to resize images automatically, that was like the big thing. And then iPad handles, you can do, iPhone does it as well, but on iPad, it's a bigger deal for dynamic type. And once we kind of constrained our dynamic type to not be like super gigantic text, like one letter is the size of like half the screen. If you constrain it a little bit, then you have an app that works on iPad pretty easily. So
Android, I'm worried about though. Some devices won't even honor your contracts for certain events. Like if you tell them you can only pick this many images, some devices just will say, we'll pick as many as we want. So that I'm worried about. But we'll cross that bridge.
There must be a hierarchy of, you know, the top 2 or 3 Android support devices have the lion's share. Or maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, from whatever publicly available data we've got. Yeah. And that's what we're targeting.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it's, that's the thing. If it's,
it doesn't sound,
it's, say, it's a big enough issue, someone will let you know.
Yeah,
it doesn't sound as if it's changed too much from my day. It was like very much like, you know, on the iOS devices, it was not too hard to customize them, and then there was a sea of different Android options, and you had to just pick the ones you had the sort of capacity to support, basically.
Yeah. So like when you have like Pixels are amazing, Samsung higher end Samsung devices are amazing, like those are the easiest to support, but then you have these random I guess not random. They're probably hugely popular devices in countries like India or China or Bangladesh. And it's like, all right, these are a little bit harder to support because they're a lot less expensive, but they're way less powerful. So
yeah.
You need an app that can also work hopefully 80% as well on the lower end devices, you know, the ones that aren't quite as powerful. So it's tricky to, that's a tricky portion to balance, in my opinion.
But that's also a cool engineering challenge. And can I make the app efficient so that it will run on a lower end device? I think we have the same problem with websites, right? If you load all the JavaScript in the world, your website won't run on a lot of people's phones. Well, okay, let's see if we can keep it a bit lighter so we're more open to everybody. That's cool. If you had a magic wand, and you don't have to just say Django, but if you had a magic wand, what would you fix? I'll let you both have an answer if you want.
Okay. I have two answers. The first one would be, I'd love to have typing in Django. That would be one. And then second, I feel like this one maybe is a little bit less of a selfish one. I would want REST framework and channels to be a part of core, because in my opinion, I think this is hurting the marketing of Django. And this is coming from someone who has done a lot of like JavaScript. I love JavaScript. I do a lot of front end work. And I also love Django. It's like my go-to framework of choice for anything I do in the back end. But unfortunately, like we as a community are competing with VC-backed JavaScript frameworks like Next. And we need to, I think not having like API support at the very least in core makes it look like Django is a framework that only does, you know, like old server rendered HTML templates, when actually you can build very robust, stable APIs with Django and also WebSocket support. So that would be mine. I think more for the benefit of the community.
Okay. Interesting. Good. Andrew, have you got one?
The easiest one is to just say throttling. I ran into some issues with like the granularity of throttling, and you know, we wanted to restrict more of our writes versus our reads, and kind of ran into some, we had to make a more custom solution for that. But the biggest thing that's actually cost me the most time had been, the ORM is very nice. I use it a lot. I almost exclusively use the ORM in PinPlanet, with some exceptions for our analytics dashboard. But I understand that it's trying to be SQL backend agnostic with the language that it uses for some of its methods. But man, sometimes I feel like there's such a disconnect between the operations you do in the ORM and what's actually happening in the SQL. And I'm very much a SQL person. I have a lot of experience with it, and I can appreciate not wanting to require that kind of experience for, you know, the new developer. But sometimes it feels like there's got to be some middle ground where you can more closely reflect the SQL standard versus an abstract ORM of its own design, without sacrificing the accessibility to new developers. It makes it easier to come back to after a while. If you're working on Kotlin for a bit and you've written SQL and you come back to Django and you're like, all right, what do these keywords mean? What's actually happening? When does it allow me to not get the ID in this instance versus requiring me to include the ID? Yeah.
No, I get you.
Well, I think we're going to have Simon Charette on in the future, who is that right, Carlton? I believe he agreed.
Yeah. He said yes.
He's very, very in the weeds on the Django ORM. So we can pose that to him. I'm sure he has a take.
Oh, no.
We could say, yeah, Andrew wanted to know.
Right, go on, Will. You were going to ask
Okay, is there anything we didn't bring up in our discussion. Obviously people can go on the App Store and maybe the Android Store. We'll put a link by the time it comes out for PinPlanet. Are there other ways people should stay in touch?
I don't think anything else really comes to mind. If you use the app, leave us a rating in the App Store. That does actually help out significantly. And then other than that, I don't think there's anything else. I mean, it's been a really fun journey. I just want to emphasize again that like Django is just a phenomenal backend framework, and it is boring. And that's amazing. It's mature. It's stable. It stays out of the way. You know that it's working. It, you know, when you have to deal with all the other complexities of building an app, it's nice when you don't have to worry about one portion of it. You know that, okay, this just works. And that's awesome.
Good. Well, we agree, obviously.
Amen.
But yeah, I think it's also, yeah, for the two of you, I mean, it's quite a complex, mature feeling app. And so the fact that, you know, you can build it in a relatively short period of time, you should feel proud of that. And it also speaks to the power of Django. So,
yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Harut, Andrew, thank you for coming on. I've really enjoyed the chat. It's been absolutely super. Thanks for joining us, folks, with DjangoChat.com, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.